Stop wasting time with AI. Apparently, there's an 80% AI failure problem, and most corporate AI projects fail because executives jump in without a system or any expertise at all.
In the last week, we've had a couple of our clients, big clients, have got rid of literally thousands of middle managers.
It has to filter down to the guy who's sweeping the factory floor in some fashion, because it affects his life. So what does the data really say? I'm big on time, states, places, and numbers. But numbers are not the definitive place I need to end up. I need to end up with the use of that. If I didn't figure out how to do that, I was going to get fired.
Stop wasting time with AI, the CEO's five-step innovation system. This is a very important interview that we're doing here, round table. I've got two very experienced business people here with me. Stephen J. Manning, who maybe you know or don't know, he built a huge business and has worked with many, many companies over the years. He's been responsible for 40-something plus billion in commerce over the years. So he knows a lot about innovation as well, as he's created markets in all sorts of countries. Daryl Mann is here as well, and he's actually devoted his entire life to innovation, from inventing games as a child to running R&D departments and actually in particular at Rolls-Royce for 15 years. And he's also taught at many prestigious academic institutions and worked with basically innovators globally in every industry. So this is going to be a really great conversation. We're going to dig into innovation, AI, all sorts of things.
Welcome to Influential Visions. Here we interview futuristic leaders who share their deep industry knowledge and business experience with you, ensuring you have your finger on the pulse and your eyes wide open. Here is your host, Nathaniel Schuller.
So, I think just to kind of start, welcome to you both. Nice to see you. And I'm really looking forward to this. I mean, it's massive right now. Everyone's talking about AI, and we have to dig into AI in this conversation because apparently there's an 80% AI failure problem, and most corporate AI projects fail because executives jump in without a system or any expertise at all. So what do you think, firstly, Daryl, what about this, and what can we do to fix this?
Yeah, it's been a fascinating last 12 months. Yeah, I think all the clients that we've been working with, whether they like it or not, they've had to dabble with AI, and I think there's a lot of trial and error. And I tend to see the innovation stuff that they're trying to do. I mean, I think the irony is that AI already can do a lot of the what I call handle turning jobs, where there's a formula, there's an algorithm already. Yeah, so for example, in healthcare, an AI can find cancerous cells on an X-ray better than the best human can. So there are certain things that the AI can do really, really well. For some reason, I think organizations have said, oh, yeah, well, that's, yeah, that, but yeah, some of the bigger, more exciting things are, can I get the AI to innovate for me? Can I get it to generate new ideas for me? And I think that's when it starts to go wrong. I think the boundary is simple problems, where there is a right answer, then the AI is going to serve you well. I think as soon as you go into that territory of it's a complex problem, there's no longer a clear answer, there's no longer a root cause, that's when I think companies are starting to find that they're on very shaky ground. And I think that's where your 80% failures come in from. It's trying to run before you walk is a good way of looking at it. So I think that it's the AI is going to do everything for us. But my advice would be start with some of the simpler stuff where you know there's a right answer and you know that therefore the AI can find that answer.
Yeah, makes a lot of sense. What do you think, Steve, about all of these kind of failures that have been occurring, and why do they occur?
Well, the seminal idea is you really, in most things, in life, business, innovation, you really need to walk before you run. When you go straight from zero to running, you are going to fail. There are certain circumstances where you don't. The building's on fire, run. Don't delve into why the building is on fire and how to prevent it next time. Let's run first. You know, but that's a rather pedestrian example. I have, you know, being a shameless researcher, and I don't operate at the plane where Daryl is. What Daryl does is very different than most of us ordinary folks do. I've come to the understanding that the absolute clarity that I will never invent a way to split the atom. I will not come up with a cure for major illness. So when I'm searching for an answer, and I've got all these tools at my fingertips, which I now do, and I recognize the immense research value, I come to the same conclusion I've always come to. When I think I have that definitive answer, that's the answer to my problem, or that's my goal forward, what I've come up with in my absolute belief is nothing more, well, perhaps a little more, but it's basically testable hypotheses.
Right.
In other words, okay, so that's my answer. Everybody in the room says it's absolutely right. The answer is 14. Let's proceed. I then go into the mode, the way I raised my kids. Okay, now you said that. Now, if it's 14, if that is true, whatever it is, what else? Hmm. So it's borrowing from the Beatles and the Yellow Submarine, and I say, okay, now ask the next question and the next and the next and the next. Is there an end to the questions? Well, when I was raising my kids, the end was when my kid would ask the same thing the ninth time, I would say, because I said so, out of exasperation, I don't know the answer. Or later on, when I worked for a brilliant guy for a lot of years, he was better than the Spanish Inquisition ever hoped to be. You know, a little meeting with him for around 7-8 hours when you got grilled and lost weight. And at some point, I learned to say, whatever you want, it's your business. You want to set it on fire, you go right ahead. But again, you know, I think it's, I remember when one of my business partners, friends, sold his first internet-based company to Bechtel. Okay? Bechtel is a relatively interesting, important company. Off topic, but I did a little work for Bechtel later for reasons that will never be clear to me. But they went ahead and bought his business for $14 million. He had no employees. He had no demonstrable product. It was an idea. It's cool. Looked good on a 27-inch monitor, but there was zero revenue. So he came to me and says, they're going to buy my company for a lot of money. So we had this little meeting. And so I asked the senior VP or whatever, a rather supercilious gentleman. And I said, so why? He said, we think this whole internet thing is a good idea. We don't know what that is, but we should have one. Now, as it turns out, a year and change later, they sold it for $110 million to for one of the big telcos, who also said, well, it seems like a good idea. But by then, we had 100 engineers who had nothing to do. But the fundamental thing is, in my world, I think it's endless homework. And now AI provides me the ability to do a lot more homework.
Yeah.
I sit there and say, it's fascinating. I got my answer. And I say, wait a minute, what else? Now, if I don't ask, I should say, if we don't ask the next question, next or next, we just stifle innovation, period.
Well, we also get stuck, don't we? Because if we just talk about language models as one example, if you don't question the language model that you're working with, it's going to give you what it thinks you want. So you're basically like in an echo chamber, aren't you, Daryl? What do you think?
As Steve's speaking, I think one of the things I've noticed with you, Steve, is you've got an innate skill to understand and work out what the right question is, and I think that's the key to getting the best out of the AI. You've got to know what to ask it. And you've got to know how to ask it. And I think that's where a lot of this 80% failure is coming from again, because yeah, particularly when it comes to innovation, people do not know what the right question is, yeah, how to sequence questions, yeah, how, to your point, now how you get the system to challenge you and not try and confirm your already there confirmation bias. I think we live in a world where the whole education system has taught people how to find the answer to questions. Well, AI is really good at doing that. What we've never been taught is how to work out what the question was in the first place. And a lot of what we're doing with clients now is exactly that kind of prompt engineering. Yeah, you need to understand what the right question is. And we've spent a lot of time, our own trial and error, trying to work out how you interrogate these things to get something which is useful for you. Because I think the next problem is that almost by definition, when you've come up with those breakthrough solutions for the first time, they are counterintuitive. They don't fit today's logic. So, what today's AIs are really good at doing is, and they're built on, of course, today's logic. So they'll give you a logical solution to the question you just asked. They will not give you the counterintuitive answer because they've just not been trained to do that. So there's an exercise I run, because I think one of the things we're seeing right now is that a lot of these generative AIs, they're all pretty much based on the same algorithm. So how do you test whether it's going to help you to do the innovation job? We run an exercise fairly frequently in workshops, which is save the Titanic. So we're on board the Titanic, we just hit the iceberg, what are you going to do? So now we're in AI world. I've noticed that a lot of people in the workshops will now immediately go to GPT, or they'll go to Claude and type the problem into Claude. And I'm rubbing my hands with glee at this point, because what Claude's going to give them, what GPT is going to give them, is logical wrong answers. It's the Claude's going to give you answers, and GPT is going to give you answers, whichever one you use, they're going to give you answers which are logical and are going to kill you. And fundamentally, innovation is about breaking today's logic, and all the AIs that we're using are built on logic. And so until they're able to break logic, then they're really not going to help you to do the innovation job. Back to Steve's point, I think what they're really good at is, once you know what the right question is, then they can go and find an answer for you. So a big part of what we do with our clients is say, look, someone somewhere out there has already solved your problem. They're just not in your industry.
I think that there's a people component, there's a silo component that you talk about. However successful they might be in companies, they do find themselves on a track, on a railroad track, if you will. They're a very large truck, very large train going that way, and they do it very, very well. The thing that I find fascinating is asking questions, because I'd like to say, wait a minute, I'm not as smart as you are. May I ask just an ordinary question? So I need to get this. I need to put in some context where my little brain works. And you sit in the room, and the question I've asked more than once in big rooms with people who I'm going to learn a lot from, I'm going to learn from them. They're not going to learn from me, but that's the reality of my consulting world, is I have said this more than once. I said, wait a second. Last time, this was a little company that has 150, it's an incubator, 150 people among them. They have a war chest of billions, and they are spending it at a vertiginous rate. Everybody has an airplane. It's wonderful. And, you sit there and you look at this team of 12 Harvard MBAs, literally, and the president, who got through college, a small college, on a tennis scholarship. Why? Well, the chairman really loves to play tennis. That would be the answer. And at some point, after I listened to an hour or two of the droning, and the thing is failing, it's just failing. But they only spent $40 million doing it, so it's okay. And it's an amazing thing when I say, well, can somebody tell me what it is that we do here? I got some 3 or 4 phenomenal grad school statements on what we're doing, the image, the corporate thing, the messaging, the this and that. And I said, I'm a little confused. As far as I'm concerned, we're here to make money. Is that not the case? Well, yeah. Isn't that our resident venture, to make money? Okay, so how does, where does this fail in terms of making money? Well, that's a very different question.
Yeah.
And that is when I did not ask the question I typically ask of senior management. So who's getting fired? Because I never got away with that stuff in my little life. I think that asking those, sometimes the most ordinary question escapes the level at which some of these people think. And I look at this, you know, I've had the experience of sitting in rooms with theoreticians. Brilliant. Phenomenal.
Yeah.
And then I said, exactly how is that going to buy me a cheeseburger?
Well, you make some good points there, Steve. I mean, I think just to wrap up, the number one thing, right, is the 80% failure problem is definitely asking the dumb questions, right? Definitely asking the dumb questions. And the random tool testing is wasting that time that you talk about, both of you guys, and it's killing productivity because people are like jumping from tool to tool, right? So So what do you think people need to do, Darryl? Like, start with the simplest possible things and then build out from there? Or what's the way to become more productive?
I think we're in this phase where, you know, lots of people are worried about their jobs. You know, is AI going to replace me? And so there's a lot of that kind of trial and error going on. I think we're at the point where, because we do the innovation stuff all the time, I'll call it a recipe book that says, okay, so these are the sort of things that AI will be able to do for you in the innovation context. These things over here, they're not going to help you with at all. So again, you need to know what the right question is. So here's how we re-educate people to think about what is the right question from an innovation perspective. Because I think that, yeah, because all the tools are built on logic, you know, all of this activity to try and work out is Claude better than Perplexity, better than this one, they're all built on pretty much the same logic. So you know, if one's got a lead for a week, then guaranteed next week, another one's going to be better at doing that particular job. But yeah, it's only able to do a pretty small subset of the innovation job. So I think another of Steve's innate skills, even though he doesn't admit it, is he goes into that room with all those MBAs and knows that they're all completely siloed. Yeah, they're all specialists in what they do. And one thing that's absolutely clear from an innovation perspective is you've got to connect the dots across the silos. Yeah. So part of asking the right question is, it's literally those dot connecting questions. So yeah, how are we going to make money here forces you to connect the dots between the different disciplines. Yeah. The R&D team have got to talk to the finance team, have got to talk to the marketing team. And in most organizations, those silos just don't know how to talk to each other anymore. I mean, in a lot of multinationals, they're in different continents.
In fact, they have competing goals.
I agree with you. Yeah, even better.
The same
way,
if you go to the biggest packaged goods manufacturer in the country, perhaps the world, and the product managers are arch enemies. So I go in there and say, gee, can I buy your data? No. Well, how come you both make toothpaste or cereal paper? You mean you don't share that? No, then can I buy it? What are you going to do with it? I don't know. Yeah. But I'll do something with it. It's, okay. So,
I think the transition that's taking place, I think, Steve, is that what you're describing there is knowledge is power. That's the paradigm inside a lot of big organizations. If I know stuff that other people in the organization don't know, then that's what's going to get me promoted inside the business, going to make me survive in this job. With AI, that's that ability to, or even the rationale of hiding knowledge, it just makes no sense anymore. Yeah, it's the person that knows how to share the data and, again, connect the dots that I think is going to be the winner.
And I don't know how you feel about this. I think it's real because it's always every innovation has that in it, subliminally at first, and it bubbles to the surface. And I played with that for an hour a couple of nights ago. But I read more and more about the corruption of data across the AI machines, AI bots, if you will. And as it is with everything, you know, The reason car thieves are successful is because they wake up in the morning planning to steal a car. And then the alarm makers make an alarm to combat that. It's a horse leaves the station. So, so what happened is there are brilliant people out there who are not well-intended. They just love the glory of headhunting, the glove, the trophies. Let's see if we can game ChatGPT. Now, the reality is that you can spend time and introduce. Who wrote, you got to wake up early in the morning, eat a lot of spinach? Well, everyone else says, we don't have anybody who done that. And then I go back and say, didn't Randall Mann write that? Well, there's nothing in the literature that he might have written that. Well, I know he has written it. Well, perhaps he has spoken about it in one of his speeches or written in one of his books. And then level number four. Now, I'm being told that there are things in your writing and your speaking that somehow tie into that. So you may, in fact, have said that because it's consistent with some of the constructs that you talk and work in and so on. So in lay terms, good God, you can game that stuff.
Yeah.
It's scary. Mm. And yeah, there's a reality that it cross-pollinates bad stuff too.
It's very important. Yeah, what you just said is very important. And I don't think people really realize, you know, everyone's talking about these AI agents, right? Yeah. And I was reading MIT Technology Review earlier, and actually AI agents are going to cause a lot of problems because you automate these processes and then someone inserts that piece of disinformation, it can cause all sorts of problems, can't it? So cybersecurity companies and the makers of these applications have a lot of work to do because it's, you know, I wouldn't want to automate anything really anymore, if I'm honest. Very little stuff, if I'm perfectly honest, because I'm worried about that.
Yeah, I think for me, the challenges come as soon as you start crossing silos. You know, so if you're trying to design an algorithm to, detect those cancer cells in the X-ray, it's a domain-specific problem. But as soon as you, cross those different silos, whereas Steve says you've got, people with conflicts of interest, then there's a strong incentive to distort reality. And once you've done that, I think when we're in innovation world, which is where we spend all of our time, it's very easy to find you've built an LLM and it's going to hallucinate for you because it does not know how to consolidate this piece of information from this silo inside the business with this other piece of information from another silo.
I'm absolutely focused. I promise that in a lot of conversations, I'm the guy who says, okay, now, what exactly does that data mean to you? Oh, it's sacrosanct. It's what it is. But what does it really mean to you? Because it has to filter down to the guy who's sweeping the factory floor in some fashion because it affects his life. So what does the data really say? To me, that's never, I'm big on time, states, places, and numbers. But numbers are not the definitive place I need to end up. I need to end up with the use of that technology, if you will.
Yeah.
For me, innovation's always been in the marketing world, if you will, marketing and media. And of course, I will readily admit that whatever I may have contributed to that world, it was under duress for all the wrong reasons. And it was, as you said, absolutely counterintuitive to the reality of the time. I don't like that you try breaking walls and ceilings and all that nonsense. If I didn't figure out how to do that, I was going to get fired. That really worked.
That story. It's a cool story.
That really worked. If I don't figure that out, he's going to just fire me. And I said, it's not possible. I don't care. Okay, dokie. Well, ask enough questions and I go back to, the newborn, every joke is new. So why don't we start at the beginning? So, I'm going to get fired. That's a very good incentive to be an innovator.
Yeah. I think one of the heuristics we use an awful lot is that, yeah, if people don't have any skin in the game, then the innovation project is not going to be successful. People need to feel the pain when things go wrong, as well as the reward when it goes right. And I see too many large organizations where the R&D team, not through their own fault, but that there is no skin in the game. And so what tends to drive behavior then is plausible deniability. So the number of FMCG industry sector consumer panels that I've sat in on, trying to find that insight that's going to generate the new shampoo or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And there's a lick at scale. So consumers are going to be asked about, what do you think about this? On a 1 to 9 scale, whatever it is. And then they'll come out of the sessions, they've tested half a dozen concepts, and this one scored 8 and the other one scored 7. So we're going to go to market with the one that scored 8. That's exactly that kind of useless data. Because in reality, it is useless data that allows them to go back to their boss and say, well, look, we tested these things and this was the winner. So you can't argue with us for launching this one.
How many times have you see data that supports or suggests a winner? And you take a look, as you sit back, say, that's something specious about that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there is. I mean, because I think if nothing else, the consumers that go on these panels, they're being paid to be there. So they've got their own bias, which is, I want to get invited back to another one of these things. So what answers are they wanting to hear from me?
That's a good point. That's a very good point.
Having a skin in the game is something that is, it's such an old concept, much the same way as when your investment advisor insists you really should buy that stock.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
My next question is always the same. Okay, so how much of it do you personally own? Not the investment bank. How much of it did you buy?
Yeah, right.
Okay, if you're not buying it, why am I? Should I be buying it? I know less than you do.
Yeah.
The whole silo idea. I'm never pejorative at people who have that level of competency to occupy a meaningful silo. Mm-hmm. That's an amazing achievement in and of itself. Okay. But if you're insulated and the company acts on that. Many years ago, and I shed body with it, but Morris Hamburg, who was a Wharton brilliant, he might have been the best forecaster in the world at the time, sitting in this group at there was this group at Harvard, MIT, and Morris. And he pointed out the difference between me and the other 23 people in the room. I was the guy wearing jeans and a T-shirt. And I ran a small marketing business. Mm. I just wanted to know how smart people make decisions instead of what I thought was the right thing to do. So I hounded all these great universities, spent a lot of money. And I sat there and I said to Morris, Dr. Hamburg, I didn't understand a word you guys said for the last 4 hours. I said, I may not be the sharpest guy here, but I'm not the dumbest. And he explained to me that I was the only one there that didn't have a PhD or an MBA from one of those schools. And those are some of the most brilliant report writers ever, anywhere.
Right.
So well, that's what the hell, what are you thing. Doing here? I want to learn. You want to learn to be a report writer? No. And me and this other guy, he's got a problem. The Teamsters are going on strike, and he heads distribution of Coors beer. He wants to know how to deal with that. He said, why don't you guys go to a bar and have a drink? Leave. You don't belong here.
Yeah.
That said, the thing for me, my takeaway was not that what they were doing was hardly useless. What do you do with that? You take those brilliant reports, take them with a highlighter, and then you put those things that strike as relevant and send them to Daryl. Daryl, what do I do with this? Daryl injects a whole bunch of reality into that.
Exactly.
And then you have a go forward.
Yes.
Yeah. So I find that clearly there's a need for those incredible theoreticians. Not even a pitch on my sorry marketing behind someplace I just can't find out of. That's silly. That's silly. In the company I grew up in, okay, for a decade and a half, the least educated person there was an intrepid boss, CEO. Everybody was like, oh, mine was shaking. I have a phony degree from a couple of big colleges, he was so proud having dropped out of college after 2 weeks. He was busy selling tools out of the back of a station wagon that didn't have a second gear. But he walked away with $500 million, and all the other people there that had their MBAs and so on did not.
Mm. Why? Yeah. Well, that's the point, isn't it?
I keep saying nothing happens till you sell something.
Exactly, yeah, right.
He started backwards on everything. Sell something. How do I get there?
Yeah.
Daryl?
We're just finishing off a book, which hopefully is going to come out in September. It's partly in response to this shift in AI-driven world that we're in now. But it's the idea of a one percenter is whenever we're going into a client to help them with an innovation project, one of the people we're always looking for in the organization is who's the person that can get it done? Who's the person that can connect the dots? And there just aren't many of them in organizations because of this specialization, the education system that's built to build specialists. So you've got efficiency inside a business demands those specializations. But I say, as soon as you decide, okay, I need to innovate now, those specializations are going to kill you if you're not careful. And so the one percenter is that person that can literally look horizontally across the silos in the business. And one of the key traits of those individuals is they did not get on well with the formal education system. They probably dropped out at some point. And when you dig into that, we realize that the whole education system globally is based on the Prussian system from the 18th century. And what that system was geared up to do, so the Prussian empire at that time lost a number of battles. And so the realization was, we've got a bunch of soldiers who are not smart enough. So therefore, we need to design an education system that makes them able to follow orders. And then very quickly after that, a realization, we don't want to make them too smart. We want people who are smart enough to take orders, but not smart enough to question the orders. Wow. And we all come through that education system. And it drives an awful lot of creativity out of us. Number one, we know how to follow orders, and that's what business needed. And the deal was that because I've went through that education system and became a professional, I got to be pretty successful at it. I earned a good salary because businesses wanted efficiency. Yeah, what AI is now doing is saying, but the AI can do all that stuff. Yeah, now we need those one percenters that can cross the silos, and they're not coming from the education system. So I think an awful lot of people are getting this shock that says, I bought into this deal of I specialize and I learn to follow orders because that's how I make money, and increasingly that's not the way you're going to make money anymore. So I love your story, Steve, about the CEO that had the least education. That's the person that walks away with all the money because they're the one with the life skills. But again, they can
My best friend for 30 years, that I spoke to 5 times a day for 30 straight years, something of a burden, I promise you, but without a doubt, other than you two, was the smartest human I've ever met. And when he was in high school, he went to a Catholic school in the East somewhere. And when he was back in the 12th grade for the second time or third time, the nuns brought the parents in and said, best teach him a skill, a plumber, electrician, a mechanic, because it will never amount to anything. Okay, go tell him that after his several major successes in business. Just a wonderful thing.
It's funny.
The person connecting the dots, just a little minor side note. Often, enlightened CEOs, I'm not talking about your Fortune 50 or Fortune 10, but enlightened CEOs oh, we have a problem. We have a project. We need to do this. Buildings on fire. We need to do this. So who do we give it to? And the question is, well, who's the busiest man or woman in the company?
Yes.
That'd be Daryl. Yeah. Give it to Daryl.
Yeah.
Daryl, we need you to take over operations. Only 10 million square feet, only 10,000 people. Need you to take over operations? To which the answer is, with due respect, one, I don't know where the buildings are. I kind of know how it works, but not really. And I'm already working 60, 70 hours a week. I'm on an airplane, every 10 days.
But this says, leads us, though, Steve. This leads us.
I got to go. You'll figure it out.
We're back.
I better figure it out and get fired.
It's taking us to the next point on the on because we've got five talking points that we need to get through. So this TRIZ thing, I have no idea what TRIZ is, but I know it's a proven innovation framework, and hopefully Daryl will explain a little bit about that. But obviously we've got AI now, which is the elephant in the room, and it can it can scan millions and millions of patents. It can instantly surface solutions, right? So. Yeah. Obviously, when you put these two together, is that real innovation or perhaps not? Because actually, the AI is going to, send us maybe in the wrong direction, Daryl.
I think the AI can very easily do that. When it's hallucinating, it can very easily send you in the wrong direction. So I think the TRIZ methodology, which I don't recommend anybody does a Google search on or even use their AI to investigate, because it's a very confusing story. Like a lot of major discoveries in life, it happens completely accident. So it happens in the Soviet Union, starts just after the Second World War, when a group of engineers are told, go and study patents and go and find the good ones. Great question. Of course, nobody knows how to answer that question. So they spend a number of years trying to work out, okay, so what is it that makes a good one? And they produce this methodology. And of course, then when the Iron Curtain came down, a lot of them started to move to other parts of the world. Let's go and make money, set up in a TRIZ consultancy in other countries. And what they all realized very, very quickly is, if I make this sound really, really complicated, then that was going to be really good for my fees. Yeah, I can just sell consulting. There's one of my good friends. He earns a lot of money from one of the Fortune 50 companies, and he's basically convinced everyone inside the company, you'll never learn this stuff. You just need to keep bringing me in. Nice work if you can get it. So I came along and I said, hold on a minute. Does this really have to be as complicated as this? Is there some way of making people useful after a couple of hours? So a lot of my workshops, I'm given a day with a team. I'm going to have 1 or 2 hours at the beginning. I'm going to tell you a little bit of TRIZ, and then we're going to spend the rest of the day looking at your problem and hopefully coming up with a breakthrough solution at the end of the day. Whole ethos was, let's just strip out all of the complexity here. Let's just get to the guts of what is it that makes a successful innovation attempt? Because what we know is, we've spent the last 25 years, we've analyzed 11.5 million patents now before all of the AI tools came along. Hence we know, because we did it manually, how easy it is for the AI tools to hallucinate. We try to distill things down to the guts. And so I think where we end up is, what I was saying earlier about innovation starts with breaking logic. TRIZ, in the way that we deploy it with companies, is effectively rules for breaking rules. So there are millions of ways of solving a problem badly. Yeah. So when we do have a brainstorming session in a company, for example, every spouts out ideas for 20 minutes, and then whoever shouts loudest, that's the idea we're going to go with. It's not a great strategy for making progress. TRIZ says, there are millions of ways of solving a problem badly, but there's a very small number of ways of doing it well. Yeah, and so you can have a much more structured So we could tend to call it trend storming or principle storming inside a business, which says, okay, we can home in much more quickly on what are the breakthrough solutions going to be, take out an awful lot of the waste and frustration that people have, and get to the good stuff in a much shorter time. So hence we call the company systematic innovation. Yeah, so the system is basically, right, there are rules for breaking rules.
Right. Right. Absolutely. So in terms of the AI and actually making that easier for innovation, it's not really something that, well, obviously it will improve it and it'll help, but obviously if the data is wrong, it's not really creating. I mean, you're going to be able to use it, aren't you? But you still need to have the people-centric kind of element, which is what you're talking about.
I think basics, right? Yeah, if I look at how our business has shifted over the last 25 years, when we started, I would say that 80% of what we did with clients was, you've got a technical problem and we'll use Triz and various other tools to give you a solution to that technical problem. I would say for the last 2 or 3 years in particular, things have flipped almost completely the other way. I would say that 80% of the innovation challenge is all the people stuff and 20% of it is the technical bit. Yeah. Wow. Emotional intelligence becomes the dominant part of the story because people love change, but they hate being changed. And what an innovation project does is it kind of forces people into doing things that they don't particularly want to do. So I think there are aspects of Triz, like the idea of using AI search pattern database. So let's give you an example. So working with a company, they make oil paints. And customer frustration is if I leave the oil paint tube around for a few months, open it up, the oil separated from the pigment. Okay, classic technical problem. Someone somewhere solved your problem. We go to the patent database and you find very quickly, peanut butter has got the same problem. You've got particles and you've got oil holding it all together. And if you open a jar of peanut butter today, you'll never find the oil separated from the peanut butter, from the peanuts, because 15, 20 years ago, they solved the problem. So we were able to go to the client and say, okay, well, here's the additive that they use in peanut butter. Just use a bit of that additive in your oil paint and problem solved. Yeah, lovely, simple project. Yeah, works very, very quickly, very easy to demonstrate it. So that's where AI is going to help you. You knew what the right question was. Yeah, I need something that's going to prevent this thing from separating from this thing. When you get into, I think, more complex problems, then back to the idea of silos and crossing silos. And Steve, you said it. The aims and the goals of one silo is different from another one. What you've got there is what Triz would call a contradiction. What we normally think of as a trade-off situation. So if we've got these conflicting goals, what are we going to do? We're going to find a compromise solution, which is in many ways the opposite of innovation. As soon as you compromise, you've not innovated. So the database we built says, okay, well, the really smart people in these situations try to find the cliche term win-win solution. We need to find a situation where we both win, and now we can progress and customer's happy, we're happy. The AI tools just cannot do that job at all right now. We're training AI agents to do that rules for breaking rules stuff, but it needs a very different architecture of software. So it's still in the realms that the human being needs to find what those contradictions are, those trade-off situations. And that's where I think the thinking comes in. And that's where you need a room of people to say, okay, well, here's the conflict we've got. Here are some solution ideas from Triz, but fundamentally it's those individuals that are going to have to be creative now and turn those abstract ideas, those clues, if you like, I tend to call it clues, into something that they can then at the end of the session say, we found a solution here where everybody wins.
Right. That makes a lot of sense. I mean, Steve, on some of your experiences, I know you talk a lot about the abacus and keeping things really quite simple, and actually it makes a lot of sense in this context, because if you're not asking the right questions and you're not following the human approach, then you're not really going to get what you want, right? I know you've got some, you've got a great story about that.
Well, I think that in my world, there's a point where a confluence of things falls apart, where all our data, all our research suggests this, and we're going to implement it. Okay? All the data, all the research, and its quality suggests this. And then I said, well, have you asked your mom how she feels about that? Because that might be, maybe she's the profile of your customer. So the whole customer-facing understanding component, it's then couched in this amazing amount of very sophisticated research. Now, and I will often default to something that's so ordinary that I get scoffed at. Are you kidding? No, not really. Now, just to be clear, I was in the AI world in the 80s. We got big data in the 80s. We got AI in the 80s. I was just too dumb to call it AI. McKinsey did that. I called it synthetic data. But so I get that. This group of people, very, very smart, very successful, came up with this very good idea. It really was. Great business idea. Turned out to be pretty good. That would service a retail channel of essentially single unit retail stores, 70,000 of them. Okay. Now, every one of those is a little store called mom and pop, a single proprietorship. Add 70,000 of those together, that's a legitimate target business, right? Now, their number one competition is the major retailers in the product line. So they came up with this brilliant idea, a reverse auction platform. So for goods and services, the retailer can compete with the big boys.
Yeah,
nice. The big boys can afford to buy that, and they get really good pricing. I'm a little guy. I'm not going to do that. So these guys come up with a really cool reverse auction platform. What they asked me to do is help create the pitch so they can raise a ton of money, which they did very successfully. I was not entirely proud of the executive summary I wrote because I was selling ice to the Eskimo and the dead of winter. But, okay, so now, and then they went about and created a really cool marketing and media plan. I gave them a business plan, but not, and this is how they're going to sell it. So that's when they come back and say, we tried it in a couple really relevant geos. Areas, and it's stillborn. It's awful. We can't sell it to anybody. And it doesn't make sense because it's clear and obvious benefit. So I looked at this beautiful plan, multimedia, all of that. And I said, you know what? This is fine. So I took the CEO, a rather elegant gentleman, and I said, do you have a pair of really good walking shoes? Of course. And so I said, I'm going to come to New York, and you and I spent 2 days together, develop a marketing plan. We have one. No. So I created a one-pager with 8 bullet points. This is what we are offering. This is your benefit, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. This is your cost. This is why it's a tremendous net benefit. I'm telling you, a rather sparse one-pager, because that was the business. I can't buy the same stuff the big boys buy for the same money, so I can't compete. And I went to New York, and I said, and I brought along a sales contract, which is a page and a half, which says, yeah, I want this. And then I said, well, let's take a walk. So for 2 days, we walked Manhattan. Up and down, because they have a couple thousand of those in Manhattan. And this poor guy, I walked his feet off. He lost a tie about an hour into it. And then we walked into the store and say, hi, we're doing this. Are you interested? Let me show you. That makes sense to me. What's going to cost me? Nothing. How long will it take? About a week. Am I, I can't really do this? Yeah. And I said, by the way, if it doesn't really happen that way, guess what? You've gained a couple computers. It's great. So we got a lot of contracts signed.
Wow.
And then at the end of that 2 days, I said, okay, now we go to 70,000 more. Well, no. So we created a direct mail piece that was as ordinary as those come. Dear Joe, like your one of your competitors, you know, on Third Avenue, we did this. Would you like to do this as well? And here's the one pager. They sold the company for a ton of money day one. Now, so the question I ask myself is, I remember being a freshman in college where I took a detour and took a whole bunch of math, chemistry, engineering, and physics classes. So I thought I'd be an engineer. God forbid you want me designing your bridge. And if you were found with a calculator, you were failed. We use slide rules. And guess what? The building's going to come up, fall apart. You know, and of course, the abacus was kind of cool, and you could use it as it was a great demo piece making speeches. But sometimes I think we get mesmerized by the big machine that's going to do everything for us, and we ignore the nut behind the wheel. You know, that's my, you know, what's the most dangerous thing about an automobile? It's not 4,000 pounds, or not 400 horsepower, mindlessly going that way. Bad roads, bad weather. God knows what. No, it's a nut behind a wheel. And we 100%. Are, that's what we're dealing with. Whether it's a client, whether it's a prospect, we need to understand their needs, wants, desires, and then see if we can address them. We can satisfy that we can address them. And that's what puts the people component to all of this, which I think is sorely lacking at the, in the uber ranks of the thinkers, you know. I cannot buy apples at the market with Uber theories.
Exactly. I think I love your abacus metaphor. I mean, it's I think one of the impediments to innovation that I see when I'm going to a lot of clients is that in evolving their current products, they've accumulated terabytes of data. You know, they understand everything about consumers, customers. I come along and say, all that stuff's not going to help us now. If you genuinely want to make a step change, then you're going to have to accept you're throwing all that data away now, because none of it's relevant anymore, because you're going to do something completely different. And that is pretty traumatic for people, because there's a lot of comfort in data. People's whole job is running surveys and accumulating even more of that data. And at certain points in the evolution of a business, it's really important that that happens. But as soon as you realize that we're in a whack-a-mole game now, so every time I try and improve something, something else gets worse, then that's a pretty good signal you need to innovate now. And that's the point also where you need to say, okay, well, all this stuff we've accumulated, it was great, but it's not going to help us anymore. Yeah, we need to get the abacus out now.
I learned amazing lessons from the least apparently relevant sources, young people who didn't know. And that's why I kept saying, you know, to a newborn, every joke is new. It's certainly the biggest company I've ever run. There came a point where I just dismissed the entire senior operations group. And elevated the kid. I called them
I love young that people story.
Because they story. Had ideas, and the whole thing about, well, we've always done it that way. We have all this data. The engineers, we've always done it this way. That's the way it works. Tell that to the 19-year-old kid who says, I don't think so. Well, speak up.
What we
did, we learned, of course, from others. Wozniak was found talking about early meetings at Apple. You know, I had a good friend who was on the board and worked at Apple, you know, Fred Hoare. And he said, you know, Jobs called a meeting. Everybody's invited is involved. From the people drafting the boxes to everyone. Everyone and everyone has a voice, an equal voice. Speak up or you're not going to get invited again. Yep. And then we did what Steve wanted. So
yeah, of course. It sounds like my dad.
That's not what we did. That's not
my
what
dad
we
used
did.
To do the same. Yeah,
we let our people spend money to prove what that they might have a grain of a good idea. You can stay up 10 times, 11 times. An innovative idea will pay for all your sins.
Yeah, I love
and
that.
And that's
actually
how you keep people involved. That's how you keep people, particularly in vertical companies, which just do the same thing more and more and more and more over and over.
Yeah.
You're not growing this way, you're growing this way. That's one of the ways you keep people interested and motivated, by allowing them, oh, forgive me for the new age stuff, allowing them to fail, which we did routinely. And I think that was a real cornerstone of our growth. We let all these smart young people who had no real idea test something we knew was going to fail. Mm. You know what? The 10th time that didn't fail. Oh, my God. And now you pay for all your sins.
Yeah.
You know, I think I learned that from Fred Hoare told me about how Steve Jobs did that. We thought that he was a pretty smart guy.
Yeah, I think it's for me a classic example of founder mentality. I think founders tend to be much braver at disrupting the business. So that idea of we need to make a step change now, we need to find different ways of doing things. I think a lot of professional managers, the people that are brought in to manage those verticals inside the business, they don't have that mindset. And I think a classic example of that is Starbucks. Yeah, so when Howard Schultz is around and in the business, you can see that they've got that founder mentality. It's okay to try things out. I think he's a person who clearly understands fast failure. Yeah, you learn from failures. Yeah, make sure you design intelligent experiments. Don't repeat failures that you've made previously, but you've got to fail in order to succeed. But I think a lot of the professional managers that are brought in who are not the founder, I don't think they see the world in that way. I think that the MBA mentality is it's not okay for me to fail. I don't want failure on my track record. So much as I go in and say, look, we need to learn here. So don't call it failure, call it learning. Then there's an enormous reluctance to do that.
Starbucks is interesting because actually I have a friend who is a consultant at Starbucks, has been for a long time. He's an uber intellect. He refuses to talk to me about Starbucks. I wonder why. we had a bit of a intellectual falling out when the uber brainiacs decided to shut down the stores for half a day and to educate the baristas to engage customers in socially relevant conversations. Now, you'll have to forgive me because I actually hold this, that I can learn from everyone I encounter. I can learn from the kid that's going to park my car in the office building. I can learn from the guy who should be institutionalized. I can learn from everyone.
Mm-hmm.
I do not want to be engaged in a heavy-duty social, economic, political, genetic, religion discussion with a barista. I'm not denigrating baristas.
That's hilarious.
I'm not denigrating baristas. That's not the point. But in my otherwise, very long day, I may just solicit an answer. But at the same time, the same week in LA, they decided to close the bathrooms to all the homeless and vagrants that were tramping through the stores.
Ooh.
I'm a little confused. I don't get it, but I did disable my Starbucks app. That was just a childish tantrum, I suppose.
Onto the executive AI stack, right? Free tools that work. Focus on AI that boosts productivity. So what sort of ideas do you guys have about that? I mean, over to you, Daryl, first. I mean, I use a lot of tools to help me with faster planning, decision making, knowledge, learnings and stuff like that. What do you think?
I think we're back to this boundary between the simple problems and the complex. So again, yeah, what is the distinction? A simple problem is one that's got a right answer. You can look for a root cause to the problem. And AI is really, really good at that. So yeah, like everybody, yeah, I use GPT tends to be my generative AI of choice. I've kind of trained it to challenge me, for example. Yeah, so prompt engineering becomes really, really important. And I know there are certain things it will do really, really well for me. Yeah, so as I'm writing chapters of the book this last week, yeah, there are certain sidebar stories where I'm just looking for a pen portrait, for example, of Reed Hastings or somebody like that. I want a pen portrait of Reed Hastings, and I want to emphasize these characteristics that he's got. Give that to GPT, and it'll come back with a couple of paragraphs, and I may change 10% of it. But that's what the AI is really, really good at doing. I've given it a simple problem. I've given it some context, and it will come back with something which is usable. As soon as I cross that boundary into complex, then I've now given up even trying with it because it's just not going to be helpful. There are too many hallucinations there. So right. I think the human's got to do the thinking. And in that sense, I think we're back to the early part of the discussion about you've got to know what questions to ask. So when it comes to those complex questions, why is the CFO behaving the way that she is or he is or whatever? You're not going to get an awful lot of insight from GPT on a question like that. You need to generate some EQ from somewhere and go and have the difficult conversations that 2 years ago we would have all had. I think there's increasing propensity. I've seen it with several clients actually where they've delegated the difficult conversation to AI rather than go and talk to somebody and say what did you do that for and how can we avoid that in the future. And businesses that prevail, resilient businesses, are the ones where they're happy to have those difficult conversations. And I think it's too tempting for a lot of executives to delegate the difficult conversation to an AI.
Wow.
Well, it's 10 years ago, a CEO whom I've known for a long, long, long time, very successful medium-sized company, he would send me everything to read. And the communication with the Attorney General of the state of New York and this and that. And then one day he sent me a long letter. Could you read this? It doesn't sound right. It's a long letter he wrote to his wife about some discontent they have. 2.5 pages of pouring his soul and heart out and about how he feels. Obviously loves her. They have 4 kids, been married for 28 years. And I called him. I said, are you out of your mind? I mean, you're living with this wonderful woman, so as I can tell, for all these years.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know if I'm communicating this properly. Okay. So I said, it's highly presumptive for you to ask me. I love you to death, but okay. So I took an hour and I went back and I said, here's my suggested letter. Dear Anne, I love you very much. I think the world of you. We clearly have some issues that we should discuss. I'm going to take day off from work tomorrow. Can you and I go to the coffee shop here in New Rochelle and have breakfast? And let's talk it out, and we'll figure out. I love you. So just let me know if that's okay.
Yeah.
Are you kidding? No. No. A young man I know. I tell this for a reason. Young man I know, he's is chief technical. He's got a really cool title for an enterprise in a club world, if you will. They do about $500 million a year. He tells me with pride that he wrote this really good email to the supplier, copies to his boss, because they're just not performing, blah, blah. And it's a couple $1 million contract a year, and I said, but you are their biggest client. And the reason the email is good because he had ChatGPT write it, and it's really good. And what did your boss say? He didn't say anything. Now, I know what I would have said. Dude, this is Gemini, man. It's Reeks. So what would you have done? Dear Bob, we need to review our contract. There are three things where you are failing. We need to remedy it or we'll not renew it. 1, 2, 3. Can we meet next week? You think they would have done it? Are you kidding? That man would have fallen out of his chair reading that email. The two-pager and some guy writing. Now, it's without a doubt, AI to me, the language models and so on, I don't do what you do at the level you do it, Daryl. There's a degree for you, the confluence of intellectual processes, technology, innovation. That's a big deal. That's a witch's brew that I don't relate to. But in my little world, I think this is the greatest Google research tool in history. And I can use it, ignore it, training it. Well, evidently it trains itself. So, because I do write every once in a while, I sit there and say, I know there's a better word. Okay. See, I'm a wordsmith, right? Yeah. But I can't think of it. Then I can go, cut, click, and I get 9 words and then Noantic collects details. Now, I have to ask this question, although I'm breaking the rhythm of this. And I'm going to ask you this, my friend, Terrell, which the last time AI blew my mind, it was a couple days ago. I just finished last Thursday, wonderful new book by Daniel Silva comes out, The Inside Job.
Yeah.
This is his 17th or 18th New York Times bestseller every July. Wonderful read, particularly if you like a little intrigue, you like art, you know, wonderful read.
Yeah.
So he uses this Italian word a couple of times in the book. It actually comes used in context of brushstrokes and all of that. Sfumati, which is smoke dissipating slowly in the air. So I'm writing something and I said, I just bought the book the day it came out. I read it overnight. What a great book. When I'm sitting here, I don't remember the word, 2 days after the book came out. So I went to a couple of these wonderful tools.
Mm.
And I said, in Daniel Silva's new book, The Inside Job, he uses a great Italian word that stands for, I wrote colloquially, it stands for like smoke dissipating in air. Count it down, 1, 2, 3. In 3 seconds, I got 6 paragraphs about the book, about the use of the word. What does the word? I'm a little confused. When the heck did those bots read the darn book? It just came out yesterday.
It's funny, isn't it?
Yeah, I need to ask you how the heck that happens.
Yeah, what you hope is happening is that the reviews are out. And that the AI is picking up the reviews, but I suspect there's an awful lot of let's upload the book, legally or otherwise, such that it all becomes part of the corpus. I mean, we've been pretty protective of all the IP that we've generated over the years, but I know that some of it's found its way into the generative AIs that are out there, and we've had a rash of. I mean, we publish an e-zine every month. It's free, and we've had a raft of people who've downloaded all 270 issues, and I'm pretty certain all they're doing with it is they're going to stick those 270 issues into an LLM, and make their own Daryl bot or whatever it is, I can't do anything to stop that apart from saying okay, let's make the previous issues not available anymore, but right. I think the world's going to do it. I think it's just too tempting for people to just upload whatever's there, and I think the rules of engagement for everybody are very, very unclear. So I don't know if you've checked, Steve, whether your books have been incorporated into an LLM somewhere, but it wouldn't surprise me if they have. And somebody.
Well, clearly, Elon Musk knows more about me than I do. That's and his unfinished computer, his little grok thing, already knows more about me than I do. I'm impressed, by the way, reading it.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to challenge it because why bother?
Exactly. But when it comes to the executive AI stack, right? Like three tools that work. Yeah. But three things. We've got decision support for faster planning, pattern recognition for market trends, and we've got automation for routine tasks.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure about the automation for routine tasks, Daryl. What's your sort of take on that? I mean, I'm into forgetting the shiny stuff and go for what executives, how they can save time, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's the box you can tick. So when I'm talking about simple problems, then that's the stuff that could and should be automated. So in the last week, we've had a couple of our clients, big clients, have got rid of literally thousands of middle managers in the organization. And I'm pretty certain the reason for that is they're realizing that blob in the middle of the company, as it's often called, is an impediment. I think if you've got the people at the top that are asking the right questions and the people actually doing the work directly connected and the AI is connecting them, then that's a very powerful formula for efficiency improvements in the business, because you've just got rid of 5,000 middle managers that were basically inertia in the system and trying to protect their power. Now, how that plays out when you've got now hundreds of thousands of middle managers unemployed, I don't know. Doesn't sound great. But I think as far as the CEO and the C-suite's concerned, then those kind of economies are absolutely inevitable. Automating stuff, what we measure inside the organization, how you build dashboards, how that information gets to the top of the organization, down to the bottom of the organization. I think that's all great stuff. Your second one was pattern finding. I think that's a tricky one. And I think that's where you can very quickly get into a territory where the AI is hallucinating for you.
Interesting.
The reason for that is back to the contradiction stuff, so trade-offs and compromises. So one of the things we learned, thanks to one of our FMCG clients who have been lovely to us over the years and allows us to do experiments with them. What we found is that everybody tracks these consumer trends, market trends, and what they fail to recognize is that sooner or later, one trend is going to conflict with another trend. And as soon as that conflict has taken place, it means that those trends can't carry on anymore. So we built our assumptions on, for example, let's just give you a tangible example, automotive industry. The consumer wants an increasingly customized car. So all the options that we choose on a car. We also want a safe car. Now, that gives General Motors and all the OEMs an enormous problem because if there's a million different customizations that I can offer on a vehicle, how can I now guarantee that it's safe? That is an enormous problem. That means that your customization options are pretty darn limited. What color do you want? What kind of wheels do you want? But you're not going to change the door panels. You're not going to change the gearbox in the car. You might be given a gearbox option, but you're not going to redesign the gearbox. Much as the automotive industry says, we're heading down this customization track. They reach a certain point where they just can't customize the vehicle anymore because they hit the safety problem. I can't guarantee that this vehicle is going to be safe now. So therefore, I'm going to limit how customized it can be. So that kind of conflict's happening everywhere. So when companies are following patterns, they fail to recognize that whatever pattern they're following, sooner or later, it's going to conflict with another pattern. So they build their business plans on this pattern, failing to realize that something's going to come along probably fairly quickly to mess up the projections you've made based on that pattern.
Very interesting. Steve always has masses of great tips on these sorts of tools and things. But I think it'd be nice to move on to accelerate innovation from 18 months to 3, if you guys don't mind.
Yeah.
Because, you know, old school R&D takes a very long time. And you've got some great Fortune 500 case studies on AI plus systemic innovation, right? Systematic innovation, excuse me.
Mm.
And how that creates breakthroughs, results in a fraction of the time. So what have you got anything you could like to sort of share on that one, Darren? How do you reduce that time frame from 18 months to 3 months?
It's going to be difficult for me to give you specific examples. Let me try and give you one or two if I can. But it's, you know, let's connect some of the dots we've been talking about in this conversation. I think the working out what the right question is a very important part of the process. So before you start spending lots and lots of money, then let's make sure we understand what the right question is. So if we're going to complete a project in 3 months, let's say it's a physical object, we're going to build a part of a vehicle, for example. So one we did fairly recently was let's radically rethink suspension systems for vehicles. There's a 3 month project. So we said at the end of 3 months we'll have a new suspension system on a car going around a test track, so you can demonstrate how much better it is.
Wow.
The first month of that 3 months, we haven't manufactured anything. We've not really yet designed anything because we're still trying to work out, what is the problem here? So what does, when it comes to suspension systems, are customers frustrated by anything? If you ask most people about the suspension system in their vehicle, there's nothing they're going to offer you in terms of, I'd like it to be more like this. So you've got to try and work out what the opportunity is there. So it turns out there is one. You can make a suspension system that is probably about 75% cheaper.
Wow.
Just by changing the mechanism. So instead of springs and squashing a fluid to damp things, let's just go back to drawing board and rethink that. What is it customer actually wants? They don't want to have to pay for this stuff, so make it a lot cheaper. Let's find a way now of chopping out all this cost. So the architecture of the suspension system is going to change completely. Mm-hmm. Once we've worked that part out, then you're into the AI, someone somewhere solved your problem. So now we're at a point where we can ask the question of AI, I need a thing or I need a material that compresses like this. Yeah. So here's the characteristics that I'm looking for. Is there anybody out there who's made a fluid like that? So that's where you're going to really cut out a lot of time. You're tapping into the world's knowledge now. You've asked the question. That's going to take you outside the automotive industry and say, okay, well, let's look at every industry who's had to build create a fluid with these kind of properties. And then once you've found that fluid, someone somewhere solved your problem. There's a solution. Now you're in a position to start designing and manufacturing this thing. And because you're taking 75% of the cost out, you know that the design and manufacture is going to be an awful lot easier than it would have been making a traditional suspension system. So things like 3D printing these days allow you to manufacture stuff without having to build tooling, etc. So the technology's really shrunk the prototyping part of the process. You're ready to be on the test track, and indeed we were on the test track in less than 3 months.
Wow, that's very fast, because these things do take a long time. Was there something else that you can sort of think of that's interesting as far as that's concerned? I know you've got so many projects that you've worked on.
Yeah, again, you get into confidentiality issues, but we talked a little bit about sleep apnea, for example. There's another really tricky one where industry solves a problem. People, as they get older, as they tend to put on a little bit of weight, then sleep apnea becomes a bigger and bigger problem. So the world needs a solution to that. Mm-hmm. And so an industry builds up. Making these things, and fell into the trap, I think, of creating a less than ideal solution. Let's put it that way.
Less than ideal. Less than You're not ideal. Kidding. I actually had a housemate that used one of those machines. It's like something. It's like Darth Vader. If you don't know and you're listening to this, like. They have a machine with oxygen or whatever that just keeps you alive, right? Because you could die. Yeah, that's what I heard.
I mean, it's a pretty extreme case. You're going to die, but for people sleeping next to you, it's for sleepless nights. It's a big problem. Awesome. So this machine comes along. It's basically, as you suggest, pressurizing the airway, so the muscles don't relax and don't close down the airway. What the industry discovers after a few years of selling these things is the more the patient uses it, the weaker their muscles get. And so the more they need the machine. Now, on one level, you just say, I've just created the perfect business model now. Yeah, it's a bit like the cigarette industry. I've created a business where my patient, in this case, is addicted to my product. They can't stop using it because the more they've used it, the weaker they are. So we came along and said, and I get your business model, but it's still not ideal for the consumer, the patient in this case. Let's just go back to the drawing board. Let's think for a blank piece of paper. Let's think about what would the ideal solution be. Yeah, and the ideal solution, I think, would be I cure the apnea, but not only do I cure it, I prevent it from recurring. So these muscles that are going to relax and close the airway, how can I train those muscles to not relax? So as soon as you start from that question, we're back to this idea again of asking the right question. So start with the ideal solution. Then very quickly, you realize there's a way better way of solving this problem. Cures the apnea in the moment, but also makes the muscles more responsive, and eventually the patient doesn't need the device at all anymore. So there's another of those ones you can formulate the solution. You've worked out what the question is, formulate the solution, actually test the solution, because it's one of those situations where someone somewhere solved that problem for another problem. You're in the territory of weeks and months to build out a prototype. The problem at that point then is that, as you can imagine, the incumbent businesses say, that sounds great, but I make hundreds of millions of years from selling these machines that pump air. Right. You've got a great technical solution, but you've not got an innovation yet because you haven't done the business part of the story. You haven't understood the dynamics of how do I get this new thing into the industry, how do I get it qualified and recommended by physicians, etc. So you've done the fast bit, now you've got the really slow bit, which is convincing other people. And unfortunately, you've got a lot of people who do not like what you're doing. And as soon as you create enemies like that, then you're going to have to be very devious in order to complete the project. So there are parts of the innovation process. What I can conclude from that story is there are parts of the innovation process which you can massively accelerate. So I think your 18 months down to 3 is wholly realistic. I think there's a question mark then over the business innovation that is perhaps needed to follow on from that technical thing that you've done.
Right.
So with a suspension system, I think that's where there's one where there's no real impediment to to swapping out old system and introducing a new one, because the OEMs don't make suspension systems. They're very interested in replacing this with the new one. They exist the old with the new. But I think it's one of the things we've learned, because we've spun out 7 businesses over the years. We originally thought that the inventing part was the most difficult bit. Here we are with 200 odd patents on the shelf doing nothing. The real skill is finding that route to market.
100%.
How do I find an ecosystem that's going to allow me in, and it's going to allow me to make money, and it's going to allow other people to make money? So again, you're back to this idea of trying to find win-win situations. All the other players that are in the ecosystem, I either get rid of them or I cut them in on the action, and I make my solution of benefit to them.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, 100%. It makes a lot of sense. I mean, Steve's very good with route to market and all sorts of things like that. He created an entire industry, which is incredible. But onto the 30-day AI productivity roadmap. This is quite a big thing, because people in theory can actually reduce their productivity by just wasting time, right? So we've been talking a lot about wasting time, yeah. But this is actually, let's assume that whoever's listening to this has dealt with their problem of wasting time, and they are identifying their biggest productivity bottleneck, right? So that's week one. That's what week one we have to do. Then in week 2 to 4, we have to pilot one AI tool that targets that pain point. And there are so many AI tools. There are thousands and thousands of them. And a lot of them are built on same stacks, the same technologies. However, some are better user experiences than others, right? So then weeks 2 to 4, we're going to find that tool that we actually like, that we enjoy using, that gives us what we need. And then month 2, we're going to scale what works and we're going to skip what doesn't. Okay. So was there anything as part of that that you guys want to sort of share in there?
Yeah.
I have a question to ask you, Daryl.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
First, just a statement. I believe that the whole idea of leadership and management has changed dramatically. It's certainly in recent years. Mm-hmm. The whole thing that leaders lead, managers manage.
Yeah.
Leaders are the brilliant visionaries. They have the idea. They have the concept. And then the managers are the engine. They run the stuff. I think that the successful leader today, by definition, has to have very superior management skills. Otherwise, you can't implement, you cannot track, logistics are beyond them.
Yeah.
And that's a prescription for failure. I had the great idea, I had the eureka moment, I can go play golf. That just no longer exists. The thing that really is interesting to me, and I find it a very elegant part of the process, the consultative process, the advisory process, is when you walk into an environment, a mature environment, as you do all day, every day, and you are called upon to innovate. We have bottlenecks. We have this issue, that, whatever the issues are.
Yeah.
By definition, you are going to break the molds. Your absolute best beneficiary efforts are also perversely your natural opposition. Enemies, if you will,
because you're
going to break. You're going to break what they do, what entrenched management does. Okay, so those bottlenecks happen typically because the business progresses to a place where it just happens because the systems are not there to support the business. The right people are not in the right places. Management is unreasonable. Leaders are playing golf, whatever the circumstances.
Yeah.
And then certainly the market, the biggest Blockbuster. I had a relationship with Blockbuster. Now, I'm not that smart, but I said, wait a minute. Now, how long before the company's out there like Netflix, I know people that are playing with streaming this stuff already. You're renting, 2 million of these a day?
Such a shame.
If I had the temerity before they threw me out the door to suggest that, I said, won't you rethink it? Think about you being in the real estate business.
Mm.
They said, well, what are you talking about?
That's a very good idea.
In the United States of America, if the railroads, the railroads thought themselves of being in the real estate business, which they were. Mm-hmm. The railroads were the biggest owners of land around.
Yeah.
And, there's trains, moving. No. If the railroads thought of themselves as being in the transportation business, they would own the airlines. rather than being bankrupt perpetually. You know, so
yeah.
it's a simple focus. So yeah. The thing that has to be a very, very interesting aspect of what you do is navigating the people. Of course, yeah. But for yes. people, business would be a snap.
Yeah.
Nothing to it.
Yeah.
But when you walk in and you ask to innovate, there's a bottleneck. The people managing the bottleneck poorly might have caused it. They're into self-perpetuation. This Daryl guy's going to blow the darn thing up. I've been building this empire for 14 years.
Yeah.
So the question is, you have to have a skill set, which given your obvious success, you have. It's how to navigate, mitigate between the smart people, men and women who say, Daryl, we know we have a problem, and the entrenched bureaucracy. General Motors, why did he create another car company? He told me because he could not manage that environment anymore. Change was not possible in the GM culture. It was too difficult, too hard. So I invest $4 billion to build a car, which, by the way, had no options. You had an option of color and three models. No options. Here's the price. No options. Because he said, I can't manage the whole option environment. I'm drowning in it. But then he also explained to me that GM was not in a car business. He said, I was confused about the whole car thing. Because as you do know what we do for a living. I said, we don't make cars. What we do is we're in a real estate business, we're in a finance business. Oh, yes, and we also make cars. An interesting life lesson I learned from a very, very smart man. I would love to spend time at some other time to talk about the dynamic when you are there. Everyone knows the benefits will be substantial, but you're messing up my life and career.
You
have to fight that.
Yeah, and we as you can imagine, we encountered that kind of people issue very early into our journey. So our response to it was, before I go and take on these jobs, I need to understand the innovation capability and the openness to change inside the organization. Because take that bottleneck problem. As you said, Steve, if I turn up and say, okay, we get rid of this bottleneck by just starting again completely with a new production line, that's not going to make a lot of people happy. Now, in some organizations, they would say, great, let's go for it. Yeah, show me the economics and I'll do that. But in most organizations, as you said, there's a lot of vested interest in protecting stuff that people know about. So we built this innovation capability model. Wherever I can, before I go to a client, I'm trying to establish where they are on that scale, because that's going to frame how we go through the bottleneck reduction problem. It's going to limit what kind of solutions I'm going to suggest to them. So we do an exercise in workshops, which is a confectionery factory. So it starts with a real case study, making liqueur chocolates. So I've got chocolate mold, I've got liqueur that I'm going to pump into it, seal it up, drop it in foil, and then ship it out to consumers. If you use the process we've got, then the bottleneck in that process is ironically the bottleneck. So if I've got to pump the liqueur through the neck of the bottle, the liqueur is viscous. It doesn't like being pumped. And so one of the lovely solutions to the problem that the process will give you is, well, why don't you just freeze the liqueur and dip it in molten chocolate? Yeah, lovely idea. But if that means you've now got to scrap your production line and start again, you've just made a lot of people unhappy. So at the other end of the scale is the strategy that says, why don't you just turn the bottle upside down, and fill from the bottom of the bottle rather than from the neck of the bottle. Now you've got the people on board, because the existing process engineers can see, I can work out how to turn the bottle upside down. So I'm kind of turn up with a spectrum of possible routes we could take here, which is guided by what is the capability, you know, what's the openness to change inside this organization. And if they're willing to freeze the liqueur, then I'm happy because we just made a big leap. If they're just going to turn the bottle upside down, then I've made the difference. We've shifted the bottleneck a little bit, and everybody's happy. So I think it's trying to tune the how big a jump you're going to make to the capability that the openness of the people. And, we're back to the EQ story again. It's all about emotional intelligence. I think
it's absolutely critical to solve that big problem by involving the people who may in fact be the problem, and they become stakeholders. There's nothing more exciting than when you are not part of a big solution. You get to go home and tell your family that I'm one of the people solving the thing that could put my company out of business. That's a wonderful place to put people. Very elegant, and an elegant problem.
I think one thing's where we're very similar, Steve, is go and talk to the people that know. And so one thing I'd change about your 30-day suggestion, that is I'd spend more time at the beginning talking to the people that are involved in the bottleneck. Rather than managers that think what the bottleneck is. Mm-hmm. So I'd spend longer at the beginning part. So I'd probably have week one and two is let's talk to everybody.
Right.
Help to understand what the real problem is. And I think honestly, people will know what the bottleneck is. What will be the difficult bit is what's stopping me from eliminating that bottleneck. So what I'm looking for is that conflict again.
So I find those discussions, Daryl, on a one-on-one basis very fruitful. Most reluctant or most adversely affected people, one-on-one, they volunteer information they never volunteer up in management.
It's weird. I mean, I started my career at Rolls-Royce, and I started on a really small site. There's only 3,000 people, whereas the two big sites at the time had 20,000 people each. So as a designer, I'm pretty naive, but I'm also the sort of person that says, I need to go and talk to somebody. I'm going to talk to the person who's going to manufacture this for me and help get them to help me to design it better so I make their life easier. It was naivety that allowed me to force me to do that. At some point, I got transferred to one of the big sites, and I try and do the same thing. I try and go and talk to the person on the shop floor that's going to manufacture what I'm designing, and I'm literally dragged out of the shop floor because it's somebody's job to do that. There's somebody between the designer and the manufacturer that's going to do that translation job for you. And it's like, that is the dumbest idea I've ever heard in my life. Because you've now lost in translation twice there. Just let the designer talk to the person that knows. Not the intermediate.
Of course, everybody you talk to has two agenda. One that they open, and then there's the ulterior motives, ulterior agenda. Most self-preservation, job preservation.
Knowledge is power again.
Ego, all of that stuff. And that's a very, very difficult thing to navigate.
That's very interesting. That's our start point. You've got to get that the people stuff right. Otherwise, especially as an outsider, it's very easy when we've left the building to kill a project. The outsider was an idiot.
100%. Well, thank you. I've really enjoyed our conversations, as I always do, and we appreciate you listening. And do subscribe to this channel. Also, go to MondayInfluencer.com and sign up for that. We're doing a $1 month one trial, and you can get so much more management training, sales training, all sorts of amazing things, as well as our weekly digest as well, which gets delivered to you. So thank you. Cheers, guys.
Thanks for the opportunity. All power to you.
Thanks very much for listening to Influential Visions. Please make sure you share this episode with your friends and business connections. And don't forget to drop us a review wherever you listen. Thanks.